This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. What do Charlotte and North Carolina have in common with Canada? No, it's not hockey, though we both have teams, although their teams are good and ours are, well, we have teams. No. Now, what we have in common is business and trade. Canada is North Carolina's most important trading partner. Hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Tar Heel State are based on the fact that we sell more goods to Canada than to any other nation in the world. Meanwhile, Charlotte is home to 10 U.S. headquarters of Canadian firms. 71 Canadian companies have operations here, in fact. So when we discovered that the Canadian ambassador to the United States would be visiting Charlotte, we thought it would be a good idea to invite him to join us for the hour. And thanks to the World Affairs Council Charlotte, Gary Dewar is in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I forgot to ask how to pronounce your last name.
Because you got it right.
Thank goodness.
It's like the scotch.
Because I am...
Not that I want to promote scotch.
Because I am name challenged, but thank you for joining us this morning. By the way, he speaks today at the World Affairs Council at the Westin at noon, and there are still seats available for that talk. Americans are, by and large, fairly ignorant of Canada and how it works and what the government's all about and how it functions. I would imagine that the reverse is not true among average rank-and-file Canadian citizens.
That's true. I mean, United States, if you're in the news as a foreign country, it's usually Algeria or Afghanistan or Iran or North Korea. And actually, you don't want to be on those newscasts as a friend and neighbor. But certainly, all the world watches and listens to American media. And so, for example, when in Canada or in Australia or in the UK, when you're having your primary debates, people are paying attention to it. It's obviously a country that is followed because it has the largest military power in the world, and it has the largest economy in the world. So it's a very important country. So, yes, there is a bit of a difference. But as I say, you don't want to lead the news in the United States as a friendly country, because sometimes that means you're on a negative story.
Yeah. It's I know I'm going to get a diplomatic answer because you're a diplomat. That's unfortunate, because I'd like to get the truth here.
I'm a former politician.
Okay.
That might be worse. I don't know. I'm just kidding.
But when you look at the United States and some of the things that go on internally and externally from your point of view to our north, do you sometimes scratch your head?
Well, I divide it in two. One, this is a can-do country with can-do people, and the greatest number of patents per capita and all the innovations that are developed around the world, most of them come from the United States. And there is a energy and innovation and entrepreneurship in this country that is very creative and very dynamic. So you don't define United States, in my view, only on the basis of the latest paralysis in Washington. Mm-hmm. It is a bigger country than that. There is differences of opinion in D.C. There's differences of opinions in other political areas. But overall, this is a very dynamic country, and it is very exciting to work with it.
How would you describe your own country?
It's very steady hands on the wheel. It's also very dynamic. It has a lot of things going for it. With the government in place now, some of the issues that you're wrestling with in the United States, for example, the deficit, yours is about 8% deficit as a percentage of GDP. Ours is down to about 1.2% as a percentage of GDP. We have a stable banking sector. That doesn't mean we don't believe in entrepreneurship, but we didn't go through the housing crisis the bailout of banks, so that's on the plus side. But we look at the United States and their patents per capita, and we're trying to catch up.
Is the reason you didn't go through the housing crisis has to do with bank regulation, doesn't it?
Regulations and inspections, yes.
And how would you – I don't know whether you know what our system is like enough to comment on it or compare it, but how would you compare the regulations you had in place back then and still have in place today that kept your banks solvent and prevented you from going through the housing crisis that we went through and the bank crisis that we went through. How would you compare the two regulations?
Well, in Canada, the floor is regulated for consumers and for banks, and it is inspected to ensure that there are no loans or credit given that aren't backed up in a prudent way. Mm-hmm. The sky is not defined. So if a Canadian bank wants to invest in the United States, and some of our banks are, they can do that. If they want to invest in Mexico and in the Americas, they can do that, and some of our banks are doing that. So we don't believe in controlling the creativity and entrepreneurship of our banks, but we also believe the public and consumers have rights to a predictable floor of regulations to protect their to protect our financial institutions.
How is healthcare viewed in Canada? Is it a right or is it an obligation? I mean, that's not even the right question. Is it a human right or is it something you get if you can afford to pay for it? I know the answer to the question. I'm just going to ask.
Well, Canada has, and healthcare is complicated because there's different degrees of healthcare. But you know, there's the quality of life issue. Mm-hmm. Do you get? Is it a right for me to get Botox or whatever it is that to improve this ugly mug that I've got? But on the life and death medical care, access to doctors, access to hospitals, that is paid for through the tax system. And because people pay taxes, they paid for a healthcare system through their government. It is, in comparison to the United States, running at 11.6% of GDP. The American healthcare system is running up to 18%. Canadians also have choices. 90% of us live within 60 miles of the border. So in my former province, Manitoba, the Mayo Clinic is a nine iron in Minnesota away. If you're not happy with the choices you can make or the decisions you make in the Canadian healthcare system, you're certainly able to purchase healthcare in the United States.
With your own money or with healthcare money from Canada?
No, you have your own money. But the healthcare system in Canada is affordable. I would say the one difference being working here in the United States and going to the medical systems here, which are excellent, is that if you have a medical procedure that's elective, in Canada, the person who is most at risk gets the earlier elective surgery. The doctors prioritize cases on the basis of medical need, and that is different in the United States where you can get priority based on what you're willing to pay.
So you said it was 11% of GDP.
11.6, yes.
So what does that do to the tax rate? What's the average tax rate in Canada for an average person?
Well, the average tax rate is higher. It depends on which province you're in. The corporate tax rate, which is, of course, important for North-South trade, averages around 26% provincial and federal tax. The U.S. corporate tax is now at 35%, and that's one of the discussions in the last presidential debate. Mm-hmm. And now in Washington, do they remove some of the loopholes and reduce the rate, or do they keep it at 35%?
Mm. But what about an individual tax?
It's higher. It's slightly higher. It varies from different provinces, but it does pay for health care.
You were, as you said, a politician before becoming an ambassador, and you were the premier of Manitoba for 10 years.
Yes.
Is that an elected position?
It's the same as
office?
A governor.
Okay.
In our system, a premier is the same as a governor.
And you run for office. It's an elected
You run for office.
Office,
yes.
In that position, you worked with U.S. governors on trade, on agriculture, on water protection, on climate change, renewable energy. Did you work with anyone in North Carolina, or is that just broad overview?
I'd been in North Carolina before as premier. I was also familiar with the centers of excellence in education here and healthcare. I was aware of the banking, but I'm becoming much more aware of the energy companies here. I knew that Duke Energy had taken over West Coast Energy in Canada, which provided electrical and gas in Canadian utilities in Canada. So we're very familiar with North Carolina, but not as familiar enough. Having gone to Asheville, being aware of the Outer Banks. I haven't got there yet, but I'm going to get there. Visiting, Raleigh, Durham, and of course Charlotte. I was here at the convention. I thought the people of this community and this city did a phenomenal job of hosting all the delegates, all the ambassadors that came here. Felt very much at home with the Southern hospitality that was provided in Charlotte in a very community-like way. It wasn't kind of an armed camp. It was very, there was certainly security, but it was really well done. So, yes, as Premier, I was aware of North Carolina, but I'm much more aware of it today.
Yeah. We're going to be airing a program next week on the impact of climate change with an anthropologist who has studied the Eskimo population of northern Alaska. And it just happens that the two tribes that he discovered split their time and their territory between the United States and Canada. And they have to deal with different rules and regulations because of the two countries that they go back and forth from. And they're seeing some threatening changes in their lifestyle because of climate change. We're going to talk a lot about what that's doing to Alaska. What's it doing to Canada?
Well, there's no question the ice is melting in the Northwest Passage on the Arctic Ocean, which Canada and the United States both have. We share three oceans, and the Arctic is becoming more omnipresent for the policymakers and politicians than it was, say, 10 years ago. We see the ice melting earlier. We see the ice diminishing in the Northwest Passage. I come from a community, a province, Manitoba. We have a large urban center with a hockey team that's competing with your hockey team. But we also have Churchill, where the polar bears come off the ice earlier and earlier. They flow south with the ice, eating the seals. And then when the ice melts, they come onto shore. Years ago, we used to shoot the bears before they got into the town of Churchill. Mm. Now we tranquilize them, but we're seeing them coming off the ice earlier, and we have to put them in a polar bear jail till the ice reforms earlier than we did before. In fact, we had to put air conditioning in the polar bear jail in Churchill. So we're definitely seeing the impact of climate change.
Is the Canadian government working, or are they in agreement that something needs to be done or something can be done? Because there doesn't seem to be a lot of agreement here, in politically speaking, or at least not a lot of political will.
Well, the president, to his credit, when he went to Copenhagen on the climate world meeting on climate change, he did... what was really important, try to get a larger enrollment in climate change, because Kyoto had a small enrollment in that international agreement. United States has pledged a 17% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2020 over 1995. Canada has pledged exactly the same amount. Our prime minister was there in Copenhagen with your president. Of course, people condemn it as not doing enough. Mm-hmm. Other people condemn it as doing too much, and probably the president got it just about right. What have we done since then? Light vehicle emission standards. When people talk about clean air and clean water, they usually see a smokestack. Well, actually, the cars we drive in both countries create more greenhouse gases, more sulfur, and more dirty air than any other source. So we've both gone with light vehicle emission standards, which has, in fact, not only reduced the fuel consumption per capita dramatically over the next 10 years, but also has provided cars that more people are buying because they're not the so-called gas guzzlers of the past. And in Canada, we've done some stuff on coal. But we can talk about that.
And we will. We'll talk about Canada and trade, Canada and energy, particularly energy, when we come back. Gary Doer, our guest, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Children's Theater of Charlotte, presenting Pinkalicious, the musical, with Broadway-style show tunes, dancing cupcakes, and a sparkling story for boys and girls, April 12th through May 5th. Tickets available at ctcharlotte.org. And Sherpa, helping clients find talent by providing customized staffing, recruiting, and consulting services in accounting, finance, technology, and project management. Charlotte headquartered and online at sherpallc.com. Marinecorpsveteran.com. Marine Corps veteran Rob Bates served 3 overseas tours, twice in Afghanistan, and last December he went back not as a soldier, but as an embedded artist, returning to sketch the drawdown of U.S. forces. In An Age of Photography, we talk to him about what role combat artists can play. We find out, we talk about his work, and about his offline work as well, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, mandatory minimum sentencing has been part of the government's war on drugs. Critics say it's not working. New efforts to give judges more discretion.
That's the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported public radio, or 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is the Ambassador of Canada to the United States, Gary Duer, who is here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte. He speaks at the Westin at noon, and there are still tickets available for that. I just asked you off the air a question I wasn't intending to ask you on the air, but you were launching into this wonderful answer, so I want to hear the answer now. And the question was, since I don't understand how people live in Chicago in the dead of winter, how do you live in Canada when it gets so cold? It gets brutally cold in Canada in the wintertime.
Well, there's no such thing as we say in Canada as bad weather. It's just bad dress. And so first of all, you dress for it. Secondly, on a typical Saturday in the South, I would try to go golfing. And a typical Saturday in the winter in say, Canada, at my home in Winnipeg, I would try to get put on the sauna, go about 10 miles out of town, go cross-country skiing in a beautiful forest, and come back after a couple hours of being outdoors, properly dressed.
And the temperature is?
Minus 20 degrees.
Huh.
I come back, sit in the sauna, close it off, have a glass of wine with my wife, prepare a nice meal. So if I was golfing in the South, I would go, you know, have a beer after the golf game. And then, so you live, you've got to live and enjoy the weather. The air is clear, it is cold, but it's there's a beauty to it. So, and of course, in the Canadian summers where I live, there's 120,000 lakes. And Canadians love to go to the lake or the cabin or the cottage in the summer. Many people are able to afford it.
And the temperature is?
it's 80, 90 degrees.
Okay.
It's 80, 90 degrees. Water at my lake, where I go to, is 78 degrees in the summer.
Wow.
Now, it's frozen solid.
Yeah.
Actually, the ice starts to come off right about now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a four-season place. But the winter season, no sense beating around the bush. It's cold, but I would welcome all people from Charlotte to experience that clean, crisp, cold air.
We'd have to buy a wardrobe.
You would have
to. Yeah, we'd have to do that. Let's talk about our relationship with North Carolina. Then I want to move off into other topics. How did North Carolina, how did Canada become North Carolina's largest and therefore most important trading partner? How did that happen?
Well, first of all, a lot of people here have come from Canada, or, you know, there's a lot of personal connections back and forth. I was at a dinner last night. There was this person from Canada. That person's family was from Canada. Somebody's grandparents were from Canada. So there's a natural development of different potential markets. But we're close. And Canada buys more goods from the United States than the whole European Union put together. And certainly, North Carolina, we buy more goods from your state produced by your people than Mexico, Japan, and China put together.
We export $6.3 billion
yes.
dollars of goods to Canada every year. What are we importing from you?
Some car parts, manufacturing parts, some medical devices, different kinds of energy potentially, but you have a surplus of trade with Canada.
Yes.
That's why we're here. We're trying to improve that.
Yeah, the balance of trade is out of whack.
You're in good shape with Canada. You're in good shape. Well, a lot of times when you talk to Americans in Washington, you say, oh, we got a great two-way trade relationship, and they think to themselves, oh, yeah, we're buying and you're selling,
yeah.
and the jobs are in Canada. But really, in terms of Canada-U.S. trade, it is two-way, and it definitely that's why we like to have reciprocal trade agreements. We don't want buy Canada or buy America, even though it's a good bumper sticker. We believe that it costs – if it's buy Canada, it's close Canada, and close Canada is less jobs Canada. So that's why we like open trade.
What are you buying from North Carolina? What kinds of goods and services?
Well, medical goods, energy goods, energy innovations. We're buying a lot of furniture and other products like that. You name it, we buy it from North Carolina. And of course, you got your financial services here, and, right, and a number of other products.
I used to bank with your bank.
Well,
one of your banks, RBC. When they were here, but they're not here anymore.
Well, they're here still.
Yeah, well, but not as a consumer bank.
Yes.
There's this trade imbalance between North Carolina and Canada. We sell more goods to you than we buy from you. Do you make up the difference with the other states that you trade with?
Yeah, we have a surplus. You know, generally, say in agriculture, mm-hmm, which is a trading relationship we have between our two jurisdictions, North Carolina and Canada. It's a $40 billion industry. We generally have within $2 billion a balance of trade between our two countries.
And in fact, Canada is the top export destination for 35 states.
Yes.
Which I think is, I don't think people understand that. Is it because of proximity strictly, or is it because of a common language, a fairly common heritage, a very intimate understanding of each of our cultures, which are very similar in many ways,
well,
and different in other ways?
Yeah, we have the language language situation. We have the rule of law. So companies that export are protected. Their contracts are protected by our courts, and mm-hmm, and vice versa. Canadian companies are protected by your courts. We have the NAFTA trade agreement. Sometimes it's political, but it has benefited all three countries in terms of trade. We're trying to improve that with Trans-Pacific Partnership, working with the United States, Canada, and Mexico with the new emerging markets in the Pacific region. We want rule of law and reciprocity in trade agreements. We don't want walls and no protection for companies without any protection of rule of law. And so we see it as a very positive development. But the bottom line is Canada's got a high per capita disposable income. Relative to other countries in the world. We have markets that do want product and are willing to pay for it. The Canadian dollar has gone up. It was lower, and now it's continuing to rise. So we'll see more tourists from Canada coming to North Carolina, and we'll see more goods from North Carolina going to Canada.
And I mentioned that there are 10 U.S. headquarters of Canadian companies located in Charlotte. I'm just curious as to why Charlotte and why they're in North Carolina as opposed to, I don't know, Virginia or Georgia.
Well, it might be weather. You asked that question earlier, but there's a cluster of excellence in this city. And there's also in this state, North Carolina, one of the most important issues for companies is educated people, skilled and educated people. The university system here is second to none in any state in the United States. So I know when Canadian companies are looking at locating in different communities, it's obviously the quality of life, the safety of life, the safety of the situation. Mm-hmm. It's a very safe city. It's perceived as a very safe city. I believe it is. And it's the financial infrastructure is here. That's also very, very important to companies. So I think it's got a lot of going for it, but don't underestimate how important good universities are for companies.
According to a literature produced by your government and supplied to me, Canada and the U.S. share, and I quote, the closest energy relationship in the world, with Canada being the leading and most secure, reliable, and competitive energy supplier to the United States. Does it bother you then when you hear our politicians keep talking about our need to break our dependence on foreign oil when you, Canada, are the biggest supplier of foreign oil to the United States?
Well, we know that when Senator Obama was campaigning in 2008, He said that we have to break the dependence on Middle Eastern and Venezuelan oil and rely on North America. He also, a couple of years ago in Georgetown University, reiterated his commitment to make United States energy independent from the Middle East in the next number of years. He had 10 years in 2008, so we're only 5 years away from that in 2013. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's always part of the assumption of making this neighborhood energy independent from the Middle East. And we think it's doable. We think it's achievable. But we also know from all the Energy Department reports in the United States, it means that we're going to continue to have oil from Canada, oil developed in places like the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota, Saskatchewan, and Montana, and continue to see the development of energy efficiency for cars, as I mentioned, less per capita consumption, renewables. Canada's got a lot of hydropower that we sell to the United States. I think we're going to see the development of shale gas and gas, controversial, but I think it'll produce a great result for U.S. Energy sources. And, of course, oil from Canada, United States, and Mexico is part of that basket.
Gary Doer is the Canadian ambassador to the United States. Let's talk about one of the bones of contention with regard to energy, and that would be between our two nations, and that would be the Keystone XL pipeline. This is an extension of a pipeline that would bring about 800,000 barrels of oil down from Canada's tar sands, crude oil, every day, about 1,700 miles through the center of the United States to Texas. Your government, oil companies, some unions support this project, while environmentalists are against it on both sides of the border for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that they believe it will increase our already heavy dependence on fossil fuels. Where does that pipeline stand today?
Well, the pipeline is intended to displace Venezuelan crude. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Canadian oil has less greenhouse gases than Venezuelan crude.
Why?
Every year we continue to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases because we're using greater innovations to take an oil that was, when it was first developed in the sand, extracting it and using energy to extract the oil. Every year companies are improving the energy efficiency.
Because it used to be very energy intensive to extract.
Well, it was the biggest challenge was water. We were using, at its initial stages, using 10 barrels of water for one barrel of oil. We're now below a one barrel for the production of that oil. So it's gone down radically. So the intent of the pipeline is to displace Venezuelan oil and make the United States less vulnerable to uncertainty in the Middle East. So the United States is reducing the amount of oil it is consuming on a per capita basis. It is also having a situation where it's producing, for example, in the Bakken oil field, more of its own domestic oil. But it is relying more on Canada with the infrastructure we have in place, pipelines mostly, to produce oil and to fill the void of uncertainty in the Middle East and Venezuela. The Keystone Pipeline, and I want to thank the two senators from North Carolina, they both voted for a vote. They had a vote 2 weeks ago. 62 senators voted in principle for approving this pipeline. The House of Representatives, including I think over 40 Democrats, voted for this pipeline to go ahead. Every governor, now that we have an amended route in their backyard, supports this pipeline.
And 66% of Americans, the last poll I saw, favored
the pipeline. Yes, 2-1, 3-1. Mm-hmm. 2-1, 3-1 support.
And yet the president was supposed to be in San Francisco last night speaking at as the headliner of a fundraiser, and supposedly there were going to be a group of demonstrators outside protesting the pipeline.
Well, just the issue of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be holier than thou with our friends in San Francisco. But the highest greenhouse gases from any oil in North America is thermal oil off the shores of San Francisco in California. Now, nobody protests that. Nobody gets locked up on that issue. And so it has become a bit of a symbol on climate change. The irony, of course, we think, is that if the pipeline doesn't go ahead, oil will come in trains and trucks. And that actually has higher greenhouse gases than if the pipeline goes ahead.
Your options, you're going to keep pumping the oil, and we need the oil. So the oil, if we don't complete the pipeline, you either have an option of building a pipeline in another direction and selling it to another country, or putting the oil in trucks and train cars and taking it across the United States that way, which, as you say, is more energy intensive and contributes more to the problems with the environment. It also seems to me that, and maybe I'm wrong about this, because this oil evidently is more corrosive than oil.
Well, the State Department studied that and basically in their own the scientific report. And if we go by science, this project will go ahead. If we go by noise, and you mentioned San Francisco, it's a more unpredictable. But the State Department said, number one, it will have no difference on the on greenhouse gases. In fact, they said if it goes on trains, it'll have an 8% higher greenhouse gas impact. It also talked about the 42,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. There's also 1,000 suppliers in the United States that produce innovations and product for the oil sands in Canada. You're not selling upgraders to Algeria or refineries to other countries. But the corrosive issue was dealt with in the State Department draft scientific report.
So is there less of a chance of a spill from the pipeline leaking due to corrosion, or less of a chance of a spill from trucks and trains carrying it overland? Because if they get into an accident, there's going to be a spill.
Well, trains have really, really improved their cost and their efficiency, but the State Department or the Department of Transportation in the U.S. has, in their report, has said that there's 30 times greater chance of a train having a spill than a pipeline. The real challenge for us is if you look at the Yellowstone River that did break, it was only a few feet under the riverbed. The interesting thing about this pipeline, it's 40 feet below the pipeline. So when the governor of Montana was asked with the spill in the Yellowstone River, which wasn't very fortunate that it happened, he was asked, do you still support the Keystone Pipeline? He said, yeah, I want to get oil 40 feet under the river instead of just on the riverbed.
Weren't they worried about groundwater contamination?
They evaluated that, and the pipeline is, particularly in Nebraska, and the route was amended based on advice from the people of Nebraska. So the route now has the support of every governor, and they've all evaluated the impact on groundwater.
So I ask again, what's the status of the pipeline? Is it going to go through, do you think?
If it's on the basis of science, yes.
Okay.
If it's on the basis of jobs, yes.
Because interestingly enough, you mentioned these votes in Congress, and the Congress, I didn't know this till yesterday, they have no say in this matter whatsoever. Congress has no say. It's the State Department that has jurisdiction.
Well, the law that exists provides for a presidential permit for those 5 inches that goes across our border. And therefore, and that's delegated to the State Department. It's really a presidential permit. So when we build a bridge between our two countries, or a transmission line, or a water line, we need a presidential permit. So we're building it in the north. We're building it in the south. We just got to get the approval for the middle.
Gary Doer is the Canadian ambassador to the United States. We're going to continue our conversation about energy because we also import other forms of energy other than oil from Canada every minute of every day. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Wealth Management, PNC's financial professionals, helping clients achieve financial goals for over 160 years. For details, Mike York is available at 704-686-2010. And Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates care for spine disorders since 1940, welcoming Dr. Kevin Cahill, a fellowship-trained spine surgeon, to its Huntersville and Charlotte locations, CarolinaNeurosurgery.com. Mandatory minimum sentencing has been part of the government's war on drugs, but critics say it's not working. A panel joins guest host Susan Page on the Diane Rehm Show to discuss new efforts to give judges more discretion. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
It's hard to be in two places at once, but our reporters are in hundreds of places right now.
For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in Accra.
I'm Matthew Bell in the Golan Heights.
I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you a global perspective on the news with a worldwide network of correspondents.
In Paris. Morocco.
Cairo. In Mexico City.
Join us here at The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Gary Duer is the Canadian ambassador to the United States. He is on loan to us from the World Affairs Council, Charlotte, where he speaks today at noon. Before we move on to other energy issues, NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who just recently retired from NASA after years, and he retired from that job so that he could become a full-time climate activist, said that if all the oil was extracted from the oil sands, it would be game over when it came to efforts to stabilize the climate. And we were just talking about if the science wins out, we'll have a pipeline. If that science is accurate, we'll have a pipeline, but it will be disastrous.
Well, I don't agree. I, first of all, I respect his passion on climate change. And I respect the fact that people like the president and our prime minister have both adopted a plan that is very, very assertive on reducing emissions in North America. I actually think, with the greatest respect to the good doctor of NASA, that our challenge is going to be the largest consumers of oil and by far the largest consumers of coal, which has a lot more impact on climate, and we're trying to figure out ways to improve coal emissions in Canada as well with sequestration and other proposals, a different kind of sequestration.
Yes.
it's actually taking pollutants and putting it in the ground as opposed to tiny little grenades showing up in your defense budget. But having said that, we think that the issue of China building a new coal plant every week in one world is a much bigger challenge. Now, having said that, we're going to continue to reduce the per capita consumption of oil in North America. And the issue is demand. If there's demand, Canada has a supply. Other countries have a supply. You got to always go to demand. I think Fareed Zakaria the other day said that about it's reducing the demand through energy efficiency. It's not only crucial in the United States and Canada, but in the world.
Right. Put your headphones on for just a second. We'll take a call and move on to other topics after this call. But Glenn in Albemarle, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Morning.
Something that I haven't heard much discussion about is we're putting a pipeline north to south across the continent to basically deliver a corrosive product to an infrastructure of refineries that is outdated and outmoded and needs to be upgraded. Why not build a refinery at the border and only deliver the processed product?
Well, it's a good question. There's some people in Canada that argue that we should be building the refineries in adjacent to the oil sands itself.
More Canadian jobs.
More Canadian jobs. But this is the proposal all along was to displace Venezuelan crude because the regime in Venezuela was being less predictable than they were in the past.
Now that Chavez is dead, is there some urgency to complete this pipeline because things might improve if his successor changes direction?
Well, given that the biggest demand in oil is in India and China, we would not wish a totalitarian regime against the people of Venezuela. We would want them to be able to have full democracy and to have a market that is going to create more jobs and opportunities for the people of Venezuela. So we don't want a situation where the status quo – post-Chavez is regressive for the people of Venezuela. So we're not trying to gain at their expense.
If you had built a refinery in Canada at the oil sands and then shipped the refined product down a pipeline, would that be less dangerous, less corrosive, less environmentally hazardous if something goes wrong, or would it be equally as bad?
Well, new pipelines are a lot less risky than old pipelines, and old pipelines are safer than other forms of transporting oil. And the corrosiveness, which is alleged, has been evaluated over and over and over again, not only in Canada. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're building the pipe. We've already approved and built the pipeline in our own section of the country. So the pipeline is already built. Actually, I can't take the pipe out of the ground. It's intended to displace the oil directly from Venezuela. But there are thousands and thousands of jobs on the Gulf Coast of the United States, manufacturing jobs, high-paid jobs, where the oil is refined, and we gain out of an energy partnership. Sometimes the U.S. gains, and sometimes we both gain. We think this is an issue where both countries gain.
Glenn, thank you for your call. I read that we also have significant two-way trade in electricity between Canada and the U.S., with the Canadian and U.S. electricity grid deeply integrated. That's a quote from literature that I read. Does it bother you, then, that there's talk of the woeful condition in the lower 48 states of the electric grid, and there's no real effort at the moment to upgrade it, that it's a national security risk, and it could go out at any time?
Well, we have improved since the so-called blackout that took place about 15 years ago. When I was premier, I worked with a number of governors to approve new FERC guidelines that would be north and south. So we would have the same guidelines on not only having monitoring on our grids, but backup in terms of systems that could be switched mm-hmm. to protect a grid that goes out. I would say that Canada and the United States has some work to do on all critical infrastructure from potential cybersecurity attacks. And we are working very closely with the United States, whether it's a pipeline, a transmission line, or a banking transaction. We are trying to work as successfully as possible on preventing that from happening. And we share information almost hourly about any potential risk to those three sets of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I would say the other issue is, in both our countries, for example, I was developing hydroelectric that has no emissions, but people then would try to block a transmission line. We have a proposal to have wind energy from Montana go to Lethbridge, Alberta. People oppose the transmission line. Some of the same people that want renewable energy are opposed to transmission lines. I joked one time that it takes one lawyer per megawatt to get anything approved. But that's a problem and a challenge in both our countries.
Are you working to upgrade the grid on your side of the border?
Well, Canada has 63% of our electricity produced by renewable energy. Mm-hmm. 60% of it is hydro. And yes, we are.
Okay. And you are the largest supplier of electricity to the United States, and one of the world's largest producers of hydroelectricity. And you said 60% of your power comes from hydroelectricity. You also produce power from the wind, from solar, from bioenergy. That's 63% of your power comes from those sources?
Yes. When we're talking to Dr. Hansen, there's some things in Canada that he may want to look at in terms of renewable energy. For example, in the United States, at the Senate, and in the Congress, when they were proposing different, quote, climate change and energy bills, mm-hmm. they did not define hydro as renewable. In Canada, we believe it's renewable. I mean, it rains, goes into a river, it evaporates in a lake, and comes back in the form of rain again. So we think that's a pretty good recyclable, renewable source.
As long as it rains.
As long as it rains. It does rain in Canada. It snows, too, as you pointed out.
So is the government – do you have to subsidize wind power and solar power?
Well, there's been this comparable tax credits on wind, mm-hmm. But we're really not in the subsidy business on renewable energy. There has been in the past, but really the market is now – for example, wind – the cost per megawatt for wind has gone down, both in Canada and the United States. So the need for a subsidy is not as great.
Do you get
and ethanol is another issue of subsidy that we have moved away from because of the water consumption.
Do you get pushback from citizens in Canada about wind power because of the unsightly nature, and that's a quote, of the windmills that have to be up there to produce it, and the fact that sometimes birds give their lives to these windmills?
Well, more birds are killed by the windows we have.
Yeah.
So I'm still going to have a window. But if you put a little hawk figure in a big window, the birds actually tend not to hit the window.
Right.
So I would encourage people to do that, but or in Canada at least it works. In terms of wind, I've developed wind energy to back up hydro when I was premier, and we work with the farmers to get a proper revenue source for them. We work with the people that have in communities where they would get a revenue in the what you would call a county, and we found we had people competing to get the wind farms as a secondary source of revenue in an agricultural community. Where you tend to get more opposition, where was it, Martha's Vineyard or someplace up in,
right.
You know, some of our friends in the environmental movement opposed wind. You can't have it both ways. You can't want more wind and more renewable and then be opposed to where it's located.
Right.
But you got to be careful about how you do it. You can get consent at the front end in most places.
So if 63% of your power, and much of it you sell to us, comes from hydroelectricity and wind and solar and bioenergy, that means 37% comes from other sources. And I know that Canada sees nuclear power as a safe, reliable, and clean way to generate electricity. Is that responsible for the other 37%, or do you also have coal-fired plants?
We have 13% of our electricity with coal. I think it's about 40% in the United States. We have 10% that is nuclear. I think it's around 10% in the United States. And we have natural gas, which I think will become more present in the U.S. with the availability of gas.
What do you do with the spent fuel rods in the nuclear plants?
Well, we have a policy on containing and storing them. But it is part of any new proposal on nuclear energy, and there hasn't been a lot lately in Canada, that has to be very much part of the environmental assessment.
Were you ever going to – was the plan ever to let those rods cross the border and be stored at Yucca Mountain when Yucca Mountain was going to be the end zone for these things in the United States till they scrapped it?
I don't believe so. I don't want to be inaccurate.
Okay.
But I do know that the nuclear summit – that the president hosted with the 40 countries that we participated in, we were looking at different ways of reducing the fuel for potential nuclear weapons around the world. And included in that was a proposal with Canada, United States, with the United States doing some of the elimination of materials that could be sometime potentially used for nuclear bombs, which, of course, not only are we working on that area of reducing it, but we're also working with the United States on preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
We have a remarkable arrangement between our two countries in terms of the number of people who go back and forth every day. 400,000 people cross back and forth on this common border that we share every single day. That sounds like an enormous number. And I think one truck crosses the Canadian-U.S. border every 2 seconds. And yet we have very little illegal immigration into the United States from Canada. Why? It must be happy people up there.
Well, I think both Canada and the United States are envied around the world, and we both have a lot more people wanting to come to our countries than want to leave. So I think that is a if recruitment and retention is the key to a good company, I think recruitment and retention are key to a good country. So we've got that going for us. Both of us have got that going for us.
And despite this remarkable number of people crossing the border and the two trucks that cross every 2 seconds, President Obama and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper agreed in 2011 to speed up legitimate trade and travel, improve security in North America, and align regulatory approaches between our two nations. That was just over a year and a few months ago. What progress has been made toward that end?
Well, we have an agreement on really some common sense proposals. For example, if people are going to fly from Toronto to Charlotte and then Charlotte to Austin on an airline, they would have their luggage inspected in Toronto and then again in Charlotte, because we have slightly different inspection equipment. So rather than this is not a sovereign hill to die on. I mean, there's lots of issues of sovereignty for Canada. So we're aligning that kind of detection equipment so luggage doesn't have to come off. We have pre-clearance at the Toronto airport. U.S. Customs officers pre-clearing people to get to Charlotte so they can make their tea time on time on their beautiful golf courses. We are now cargo trying to have aligned policies on cargo as it comes into our countries before it goes onto the trains, both from the south to the north and the north to the south. Again, inspect it once, accept it twice. Still maintaining sovereignty. If you want to randomly recheck something, you still control your right as an American government to do that. We're sharing information. We now have an agreement within the policy privacy laws of the United States and Canada to share information so we can identify risk before they get to the border instead of after they've crossed the border.
I only have a minute left, and North Korea is saber-rattling, and we're taking those saber-rattling exercises fairly seriously in this country. They claim they want to launch a nuclear attack on us. They claim they have the ability. We don't think they do, but we do know that they have a missile that can reach Alaska and perhaps Canada. They're not threatening you, but what are you doing behind the scenes?
Well, we're working with the United States. We're allies of the United States. Since the War of 1812, where we had a little bit of a disagreement, we've worked together as allies. Whether it's North Korea or ensuring that Iran doesn't obtain a nuclear weapon because of their support of state-run terrorism and their ability to completely destabilize the Middle East, we're working together. We're working together on sanctions. We're working together on communication. We're working together to let them know that they shouldn't provoke because they don't know what they're going to provoke.
Gary Duer.
There'll be a reaction to provocation.
Okay. I wish we had more time, but we don't.
Yes.
And I thank you for the hour. Gary Duer is the ambassador from Canada to the United States.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome.